If you would, again, grab your Bibles and your outline that says there's a storm coming. Several of you have asked, why is my iPad up here? It's football season, people. I've got scores going. No. I'm joking. I have found it's almost impossible for me to time myself off of that back clock, despite whoever bought that, that it's so big. I can't tell what I'm doing. So this is a timer for me. That's all it is. It's just a timer. And you should be praising the Lord whenever you look up here and go, what is that thing? That's just a timer. Tell me where to go. Hey, Carrie Kaufman, where are you in here? Where's Carrie? There he is. Great job last week. Everybody has said what a great job you did. Thank you for bringing the word last week. I appreciate all the anonymous emails that say my job is now on the line because Carrie preached. You can now stop sending those. Thanks. You'll notice that I'm using pictures this morning because Carrie used pictures, and now I'm stuck using pictures. Apparently need more to give you to do or something. Anyway, I'm just kidding. Take a look at your outlines. And let's talk about the second of the seven churches of Revelation. This morning we're going to be talking about the church of Smyrna, which incidentally had a big rivalry with the church of Ephesus. The church of Ephesus was kind of the Christian capital of Asia. And we're going to talk about a church that was a little agitated, to be honest, that Ephesus got so much emphasis, so to speak. And so Smyrna, the city of Smyrna, distinguished itself amongst all the other cities of Asia Minor for its municipal vanity. They were really, really into their city. Local coinage, and here's a picture of the local coinage, would often read the first in all of Asia. Since none of you can read Greek, just trust me, that's what it says. Local coinage read the first of all of Asia and included the victor's wreaths or crowns, which are hardly distinguishable up there, but that's what it is. And they were very self-rewarding for the beauty, and they distinguished themselves with civic pride amongst their citizens. So they were really, really focused on their city. In fact, so much so that they were a little bit pretentious, to be honest. The way that they appear in history is they're a little bit of a pretentious city. They were that proud of themselves. I don't know if you can think of a modern city that is a little bit full of itself, but this is the kind of picture that we get out of the city of Smyrna, and it kind of sets a tone. Now, Smyrna, and I want to show you where this is on the map. Smyrna is the second city up in the seven churches. Now, if you've got that map that we gave to you a few weeks ago, you can take it out. We're going to follow kind of a horseshoe that faces upwards like a normal one. And we're moving from Ephesus up to Smyrna, which is the second church. Eventually, we're going to get up to Pergamum next week. And so these three churches are semi-coastal. At the time, they all had harbors. But nowadays, because those harbors filled in with dirt, they're inland. But back at this point, they had harbors that they all sat next to. And so Smyrna prided itself as part of their civic pride. It's being the birthplace of Homer. You remember Homer? You may have had to read passages from Homer's Odyssey or Homer's Iliad when you were young and in high school. And like Ephesus, its rival city, which is 40 miles just down to the south, so it kind of gives you a little scale there. That's 40 miles between Ephesus and Smyrna. It had a highly lucrative port. Now, the port, like I said, is now inland. And so this picture, yes, no, the next picture. Oh, I think I gave you the wrong picture. So go back to the last one. All right. See, no, yes, good, great. See, I'm bad at pictures, all right? I'm telling you, next week I'm putting them in your worship guide. I'm not putting them up here. It's too distracting to me. The picture I had was basically the beginning of the port, and it's now 6 miles inland, and so it's now just a road. In fact, the one I had has a Fiat driving into the front of the port. Okay, so obviously it's no longer water; it's now a road that leads into the side of the city, and there were just huge battlements that were put up to prevent anyone from attacking the city from the port area. And so they had huge gates that were put there, but it was a lucrative port for its over 100,000 citizens. And it funded many sought-after wines. They had wineries, a really good viticulture up on the plains that rose above Smyrna, and they had they were kind of vast, large local wineries, and so there was a big wine culture that existed in Smyrna as well. In fact, one of the sacrifices that they would make to the Caesars, which I'm about to talk about in the local imperial cult, one of the big sacrifices they would make was a wine sacrifice. And so that was easy because they were kind of like Napa or up in, you know, those areas where there's lots of wine. So because of this wealth and civic pride, and don't change the slide now, Smyrna was particularly well known for its two temples erected to Caesars. It had two temples that were official temples. Now, they were made to old Caesars. In other words, Caesars that had already died. And they had two temples appointed by Rome to have these giant temples where you could go in and worship former Caesars as being gods. Isn't that crazy? Can you imagine? Like, we build libraries to old presidents, right? Can you imagine if it was a required part of our culture to go into those libraries, the Nixon Library, the Reagan Library, since those are local to us, and you would have to make a sacrifice to Richard Nixon, or you'd have to make a sacrifice to Ronald Reagan. That would seem highly bizarre. Even if you liked those men as presidents, and I know they preceded a few of you, but even if you liked those men, wouldn't it be weird? Wouldn't it be weird to take the leader of your country and turn them into or recognize them as deity or as being a god? It was an oddity, but over here in Asia Minor, in order to show their civic pride, they would exalt these men to the level of being gods, and then they would worship them. That was very important in this culture. And so they even had a temple erected, or it was one of the Caesar temples, and they had a whole section of it portioned off where you could worship the Senate, which would be like our modern-day Senate, right? A limited number of people, very, very important senators, and then you could worship dead senators too. It's just bizarre. It's just weird to us. But in this culture, this was part of the economic life of those cities. In other words, they would have civic meetings at these temples. And part of that civic meeting was taking a break in the middle of the meeting to go make your sacrifice. And so if you were part of a large business in town, you wanted to be at these civic meetings because there was a lot of business that was done there over the meal. And while you're doing business over the meal, they would have a little break, and everybody would watch as the most important businesses went first and made a big deal out of their sacrifice. They wouldn't just sacrifice a glass of wine. They were up there sacrificing a case of wine. You know what I mean? Because that's what the big businesses did. And everybody's like, wow, if they can do that, they must be rich and we want to connect with them. That kind of thing. The same way that oftentimes many civic organizations exist today. The Chamber of Commerce and that kind of thing. It was part of the imperial cult, and it was a key economic feature in Smyrna. This gives you a little idea of the city. It gives you a little idea of their pretentious nature. It gives you a little idea of how the businesses in the city worked. And it gives you a little idea of how things functioned in their culture. They had a port culture, and they had a thriving imperial cult culture. Now, how did the church fit into this? Turn the page, and we'll talk a little bit about the church in Smyrna. Judaism was a recognized religion in Asia Minor. It preceded Rome. And so it was a recognized religion in all of Asia Minor. Now, what did that provide to the Jews? It provided protection. It allowed the Jews to avoid all aspects of the imperial cult. You did not, if you were a Jew, you did not have to go into the imperial temples and make a sacrifice. All you had to do was say, yeah, I'm Jewish, and so I don't do that kind of thing. We have our own God, and it's recognized by Rome, and so it's legitimate for us to not participate in the temple worship that goes on right here in Smyrna, or in any city of the seven cities that we're going to talk about in Revelation. Judaism was a protected religion, and that was significant. Why? Because Rome perceived anybody worshiping in a Jewish synagogue to be a Jew. They didn't have the discernment to go, okay, Christians, they're a little bit different than Jews. All they thought was, well, Jesus was a Jew, so those people must be Jews. So it's a little different flavor, right? It's like denominations. Have you ever thought to yourself, what's the difference? What's the difference in all these denominations? I can't even figure it out. It just seems like one is a different flavor of another, and it's a different flavor of that one, and all this kind of thing. Sometimes it's hard for us to discern the difference between church to church to church. It's the same kind of concept. Rome looked at Judaism, and they just saw all the people that were involved in worshiping God. And that included Jews, and that included Christians. So they didn't bother the Christians because the Christians were hiding behind the coattails of the friendly Jews. Unfortunately, the friendly Jews didn't last real long. It allowed the Jews to avoid all aspects of the imperial cult, as well as worship of other deities in other numerous local cultic temples. And actually, the temple that was up there was the temple of Asclepius. And I'll talk more about Asclepius next week. That's the god of healing. You probably read, you know, the god of healing, a staff and a snake wrapped around it. It's still used even to the modern day as a representation of healing, even in the United States, all around the world, really. And that's Asclepius that has that staff, and I'll explain all that next week. But Christianity was considered a Jewish sect, letter B, protected Christians from cult taxation, right? That's pretty financially advantageous. It protected them from cult or idol worship, which was advantageous for religious purity. They didn't have to go in and be making sacrifices to cult gods. And it also preserved relationships with their Jewish friends, which was really advantageous for social reasons, for financial reasons, and it had religious advantage. So they might not be able to participate in a lot of the businesses in town, but they could participate in the things that the Jews were particularly good at. The Jews had come scattered out of Israel, and they had specific talents in that region that Jewish people brought. There were specific things that Jews did that were different than everybody else, and so that distinguished them in the business community and allowed them to interact with the Christians and allowed the Christians to thrive in a business sense. And it's the same way today. Can you think of businesses that are associated with different parts of the world or different countries or different peoples of the world? I wrote down a few that I could think of. Italians are oftentimes associated with great leather products, right? Italians make great leather purses. Italians make great leather shoes, that kind of thing. It's very nice, soft Italian leather. And apparently that's really special. Never owned anything like that, but it's apparently very nice to have. The Asian culture, and I don't mean to be stereotyping all these people, but the Asian culture is particularly good with electronics, particularly good with electronics and cameras and video cameras and that kind of thing. Whenever I take, and I don't know if this is because of that or what, whenever I take one of my cameras in to get fixed because it mistakenly was, you know, dropped and that kind of thing, the person behind the counter, 99% of the time, is an Asian person, and they will look at it and they'll go, you know, and that's it. They know what to do. It's an odd connection, even in our culture. Germans, particularly good with automobiles, aren't they? Like when we think of fast automobiles, where's that fast road? The Autobahn. That's in Germany. Canadians are beer, right? That's all that the Canadians are good at. It's freezing cold up there. That's all they do. No, anyway. I'm just playing. I know there's a few Canadians in the room, including my mother-in-law, and I just thought I'd poke fun at her. Anyway, the Jews brought also this unique ability to connect with their community, and so the Christians could engage them in a business relationship. So this was an advantage on so many levels to the Christian, the burgeoning Christian community, to be considered protected by the Jewish religion. But in Smyrna, things were changing quickly. Much like our own country, Christians were no longer being given a most favored status. Local Christians began to lose that status as the Jews began to recognize, you know what, this Jesus thing, that's kind of cultic to us. The Jews recognized that what they're doing in our synagogues and around our city doesn't deserve protection. This is different than who we are. This Jesus fellow that they call rabbi, he's not really one of us. He's saying that he was the Messiah. We even heard that he got killed. He got killed back at home because he was one of the bad guys. And so they began to distinguish between Christians and Jews. And they would do that by giving lists of the Christians to the local Roman authorities. Or they would give lists of the Jews and just omit all the Christians. And thus, because of that, suddenly, and sometimes abruptly, the Christians were subject to all the local laws, which also required by law in Smyrna, because they distinguished themselves for their civic pride, required them to participate in imperial and cult worship. And the advantages were not worth what it cost. See, true Christians, letter D, could never offer cult sacrifices. They would never do it. A true follower of Jesus Christ does not participate in idolatry or in a cult practice. And that often led them to imprisonment. Prison usually resulted in stiff fines. That doesn't help much, does it? It often involves severe inquisition-type beatings. And it would result also in capital punishment. Capital punishment of a kind that the church, the Christian church, had never experienced before. And one of the beginning points of that persecution, what was in Smyrna. In fact, Smyrna was uniquely pointed out amongst the churches of the seven churches as being a location where persecution was about to become terrible. Just 10 years after writing this letter to the church in Smyrna, Smyrna would go through one of the worst persecutions that existed in all of the New Testament world. So as John is warning them that they're about to be tested, that they're about to be persecuted, keep in mind, we know from history what happened. We know that just 10 years later, they were about to get hammered, and many, many Christians were killed for standing up for Jesus Christ. That gives you the background. That gives you a little background on the city, gives you a little background on the church. So let's take a look at the text. I just want to give you that historical stuff first so that we can just take a look at the text. Look, it's only like four verses. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write. Remember that comes from earlier in the text that he's writing to each church. The first and the last who was dead and who has come to life says this. Number three, letter A. Jesus writes to the Smyrnian Christians, addressing their tribulation and their poverty. Now, it might remind you of chapter 1, verse 9, where John writes, I am a partner with you, I am a brother with you in tribulation, kingdom, and perseverance. Do you recall that? Tribulation, kingdom, and perseverance. But here, he takes that phrase and he says, I know, Jesus Christ says to the church, I know your tribulation and your poverty. Now, this is much different. I know that you do not have very much. I know that you are already experiencing what it's like to be moved from a most favored place to a not favored place. And how do we know that? Because he points out to them, but you are rich. He's speaking to them of their character. He's speaking to them of their stand for Jesus. And that I know of the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Wow. Yeah, exactly. Talk about leaning in to the Jewish people that are in that region. Why are they a synagogue of Satan? Why do they say they are Jews but are not? Simply because any true Jew, when the Messiah comes, would be able to respond and say, I recognize the Messiah and I am going to follow the Messiah. And so if you were a Jew and you didn't know to follow the Messiah, clearly, in reality, in your heart, you might be nationally a Jew, but you are not a true follower of God at that point. And so Jesus Christ calls them out and says they're calling themselves Jews, but they're really not Jews. Those that are truly my chosen people, right? Those people are actually those who follow the Messiah, who follow me, Jesus, because he's the one speaking. Jesus emphatically comes out of this saying, you are living amongst people that are not a synagogue of God. They are a synagogue of Satan. You recognize that, right? The synagogue was where the Jews met. And he's saying that synagogue, it's not a synagogue that is godly. That's the synagogue of Satan now. Wow. That is really strong language that Jesus Christ is using. And he says, in the midst of that, fear not. Do not be afraid. Fear not, he says. Despite this increasing persecution, in fact, the text indicates a foreboding future at the hands of the devil for a short period of time that is upcoming. I'm going to read letter C, and then I'm going to go back and read the verse that this relates to in verse 10, verses 9 and 10, actually. It's also revealed that this impending persecution is not simply Satan's temptation to deny Christ. There's always that in any temptation. There is a temptation that comes from Satan to do wrong, right? But along with temptation comes the opportunity to choose Christ. And Christ always views that as being a test. So you can simultaneously, right at the same time, experience a temptation from the devil and simultaneously be experiencing a test from Jesus Christ. Why? Because in any temptation, the Spirit of God gives you the opportunity to escape it. There is always the opportunity to follow Jesus Christ. Now, I'm going to knock you out of the historical context we're in right now and bring you back to the 21st century real quick. Think of the things in your own life that are temptations. Maybe even think of the things that you have failed at miserably this last week. Maybe think of the things that you have failed at this morning. It might be as accessible as that for us. I can remember when I was a teenager and I would show up to church on Sunday morning with a hangover from the night before. And through bleary eyes, I would try to listen to the preacher. I can remember Sunday mornings where I had just gone into a rage over the chaos in my house, yelling at my kids, yelling at my wife, and blowing out the door to go to church. I can remember weeks where I had spent my week not even thinking about God, doing my own thing, and then moseying into church on Sunday morning. And every time I walked into church, I looked and acted and behaved like a follower of Jesus. But I was not. I was not walking with Jesus. I believe that this is true for so many of us. We come into church every week, bleary-eyed and drunk on our own sin. And this is what is being addressed in some capacity in a verse like this. Yes, you are facing temptation from the devil. But it is also, it needs to be reset in the mind of a Christian. This is a test for faithfulness from Jesus Christ. Think to your own walk of faithfulness with Jesus this week. Last 2 weeks, last month. Jesus Christ has given you a way to follow Him. Are you following? Even in the face of persecution, are you following Him? Let's look back to the text. I know your tribulation and poverty, I mentioned that, but you are rich. The blasphemy of those who say they're Jews but are actually a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear. Do not fear that context. Do not fear what you are about to suffer at their hands or because of that, and it's going to expose you to the suffering that you're about to experience. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be what? Tested. The devil will throw you into prison, and that is going to engage a test. And you will have tribulation for 10 days. When you see time periods in the book of Revelation, I just want you to associate them like this. Short periods of time mean short periods of time. Really big periods of time mean really big periods of time. If it says 10 days, that could be a lot longer. It could be a lot shorter, but it's just a short period of time. If it says, I don't know, a gajillion years, then that's a long time. I don't think the word gajillion's in there, but I think that's a long time, right? It's a long period of time. So 10 days, that's not very long to actually face persecution. So he's saying there will be a short, concentrated period of persecution that is going to exist. Be faithful until or unto death. It says to be faithful and to do so up to death. All the way up to death. After you're dead, you're good. Okay? I'll take care of it from there, essentially, Jesus says. But up to death, be faithful. Do not fear. Be faithful. Be faithful even up to death, and I will give you the crown of life. Isn't that great? What did the city have on their coinage? Crowns. We're the best city in all of Asia. And what is John communicating? You'll get a crown that is way better than what that city has to offer. You'll get a crown that is better and higher than anything that city can issue to you. Don't give in to the temptations that the culture is throwing at you. Distinguish yourself in your faithfulness to Jesus Christ. It is a test of your faithfulness. You know, we're about to enter into a time where our civic or our national pride is going to be measured and even put to the test. Any of you who are on Facebook have probably already grown tired of the incessant number of political postings that our friends have already put out there. But I think it is with the best of heart, and I think it's with great sincerity. And I also think that it's very important for Christians to both have a voice and to be involved in the political processes that are around us. And whether or not we end up with President Obama or President Romney in a month and a week or so from right now, we need to engage this process with great wisdom. Every Christian should engage this with great wisdom. Please do not make your vote on the morning of, what is it, November 7th? Is that right? 6th this year? Scott? 6th? Okay. Scotty knows. Engage it with wisdom. Remember, God is in control. It says that He appoints all the leaders over nations. Wow. Now there's a mind-bending concept. He appointed our current president and the one before that and the one before. In fact, He has appointed all of them. God is the one that works out the things that are going on in this country. He has chosen our current president. He will choose our next one and the one after that, on and on and on. And He asks for His followers to engage in their nation in such a way that it shows wisdom. Do not lose heart if the man or the woman that you choose does not win. Do not take that as it's now your personal responsibility to bag on them the next 4 years. Pray for them. Always pray for your leaders. Why? Because this is a godly, wise thing to do. Tomorrow marks October, and we are the month before a national election. We will all be faced with a lot of decisions. And what are we called to do? To engage these decisions in a biblical and wise manner, knowing that Satan is trying to tempt us and God is just testing us. and He wants to see whether or not we will be faithful. It's a different way of looking at the whole picture. Christ's tests of faithfulness are meant for our success, not for our failure. Christ is not testing you to see if you can fall flat on your face, so that as God, He can kind of laugh at you. Well, look at that fool Chris. He screwed it up again. Amazing! 9 times out of 10, that guy can't, I won't even say what I'm thinking, he can't do it! He's a moron! Nope. Even if it's 10 times out of 10, that I fall down and fall flat on my face. God is teaching me faithfulness by taking me through this testing process. Followers of Christ lean exclusively on Jesus for their vindication. And it is not until we are faithful to Jesus in our heart and soul that we can be faithful to Him in our actions. He wants to do heart surgery on us, and He wants to do so through His Word. And He says to us, be faithful up until you die, and I will give you the crown of life. This is what you and I have been called to, even this morning. The reward of this eternal crown of life is for those who persevere, even unto death, for the faithful overcomer. Is that not a great... I mean, if you could just say one thing about the chapters 2 and 3 and the 7 churches, it's that we are constantly driven, we are constantly drawn to being overcomers. It reminds me of John 16:33, where Jesus Christ says, you're going to be persecuted in this world, but take heart, I am an overcomer of this world. I have overcome this world. It's the same word. I am an overcomer of this world, so take heart, keep your eyes on me, Jesus said. And then here, again, that was from John's gospel, and here in the book of John, again, at the end of every single church, what does it say? Be an overcomer. Overcome the culture, overcome your sin, walk with Jesus. Be faithful. Don't stop being faithful until you die. Is it okay to take a little break from being a Christian? Is it okay to go to Vegas and be like, hey, check it out. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. That's awesome. I need to find more places like that. No! There's no break from this. Jesus Christ has saved you from certain destruction. He has saved you from going to hell. He has saved you for the purposes of a different kingdom. Remember that? Tribulation, kingdom, perseverance. Man, I should tattoo that on the inside of my eyelids. Think of it and focus on it on a consistent basis. For the faithful overcomer, no further pain from the second death. And that's a phrase used in the book of Revelation for hell. I referenced that in Revelation 20:14, 26, and 21:8. You can look those up. It's a clear reference to hell. Not a one-time boom and you're dead, but an eternal death that exists in a place called the lake of fire. You think heaven is a hard place to conceive of because it's that wonderful? Yeah, hell's the same way. There's nothing that you can think up that is nearly as bad as hell. I've read Dante's Inferno, doesn't touch it. And that's a disturbing book. Nothing will touch what hell is really like. There's not a good word picture for it. The same way there's not a good word picture for heaven. These are outside of the human understanding. Heaven is that wonderful and hell is that bad. It's very childlike just to simply say, well, I don't want to go to hell and I do want to go to heaven. I mean, that kind of clarifies the matter for me. But the Bible says the way that you live proves the heart that you have. And so I call on you this morning to be faithful. To be faithful, not just in a temporary manner, not just in a manner where you take breaks, where you're really faithful on Sunday morning. But I mean, Monday through Saturday, come on, Chris. I got real life to live. Me too. I need to grow in my faithfulness in the face of difficulty. My faithfulness in the face of persecution. My faithfulness in the midst of this life. This morning, as we come to a time of response, the worship song that we're going to sing was one that was written for teenagers back in the 90s. I know a bit about that because I was a youth pastor in the 90s. And that's like what I did. I hung out with teenagers just about every day of my life. And they wrote this song to their generation, which is many of your generation now, because many of you that were teenagers back then are now young adults today. But it had such a powerful message that it has been extended to the whole church, and I couldn't be happier. The name of the song is Give Us Clean Hands, and the worship team is going to come up right now and help us with that, I'm hoping. And could I implore you this morning not to, I know it's really easy, to disconnect. Okay, sermon's over, got that category done, now we're going to a little bit of singing, I got NFL football coming, you know, that kind of thing. Would you remain engaged? Would you bring the things this morning that the Spirit of God is pressing into your heart? Man, I've got this test in my life. I've got this thing in my life and I've been failing in it. Or I know I've just viewed it as being a temptation of Satan. And I need to view it differently. I need to view it as a test from the Lord. I need to find the way to be faithful in my life. There's areas where I have not been faithful. Whether it's the real extreme of just walking in here with a hangover, or the real subtle of the way that you treat other people in your own family. No matter where you fall in that spectrum, or if it's even outside of those things, could I implore you, could I call on you this morning to bring those very items to the Lord and to use this as a time of response and prayer, of ministry between you and Jesus? And would you pray that God would give you clean hands? It's a picture in the Bible when they would wash their hands. It was not for just cleanliness. It was a ritual washing of their hands so their hands on the outside would reflect their heart on the inside, and so that they could walk with God in purity. Would you pray this morning that you would be washed clean? That our hands, that our hearts would be clean.